From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and let's go right to New Jersey. At least one person is dead and more than 100 people are injured after a commuter rail train crashed into the Hoboken terminal this morning during the rush hour. Officials from the National Transit Safety Board say they're going to hit the ground running with their investigation. The train also caused serious damage to the terminal. Images show it appears to have gone through a bumper stop at the end of the track, ending up in the area between the station's indoor waiting area and the platform. Passengers describe chaos on the train. Here's Jamie Weathersfield speaking with NBC News.
The people that were standing in between on the other side in the second car getting ready to come out of that door were thrown onto our side, and a young lady actually that was thrown from that way got her legs caught between the doors just as soon as it was about to make that full stop. But we were able to pull her up, fortunately.
The damage to the station includes crumbled walls, a collapsed metal structure. WNYC's Nancy Solomon is in Hoboken. Nancy, can you describe what's happening there now?
Yeah, well, right now, I think all the injured have been taken to hospitals, and the cleanup, rescue, and investigation has begun. We all the press people, all the reporters have been moved a block away from the station. We have a view of it, but we really can't see what they're doing inside. But I was in the station this morning shortly after the train hit, so I was able to see it at that point.
Well, and what'd you see?
So I had just gotten off my morning commute, my train, and I was walking the Hoboken Terminal. It's the terminus of all the train lines. Back in the day before the tunnel under the Hudson, this was the train to New York. You came to Hoboken and took a ferry across the river. So the train line ends here. They all merge at the station, and there are bumpers, as you said, and they usually come in slowly. I talked to passengers who said that the train came in fast. It didn't slow down to what it would be normal. I talked to one fellow who braced himself because of that, and then there was the impact. It jumped the bumper. It was up on a concourse. The concourse where everybody gets off their train and speeds to wherever they're going is outdoors. There's an indoor waiting area, but there's an outdoor concourse that's under a roof. The roof was collapsed on top of the train. The train was on the concourse at a point in the station that is normally at that hour very, very busy.
Well, and you speak of speed. It's being reported there was no technology called Positive Train Control, or PTC. This is the technology that slows trains. U.S. railroads are under government orders to install this system by the end of 2018. Here's NTSB spokesperson Bella Dingzar at today's briefing.
PTC has been one of our priorities. We know that it can prevent accidents. As whether it is involved in this accident, that is definitely one of the things that we will look at carefully.
So they're going to be looking at that. But Nancy Solomon, what else could, you know, have people spoken to the train conductor?
I do not believe, I mean, I'm sure officials are speaking with the train conductor, but I don't believe there's been any information about that as yet. We're waiting on a press conference here on the pier in front of the terminal, but we haven't heard yet. Like I said, all I know is what from the passengers said, that the train came into the station with and didn't break enough.
Well, Nancy, we've been explaining to our listeners across the country that this is part of a huge north-south and south-north network across the country. This is going to, I mean, the lives are the most important thing, but this is really going to tie up commuter traffic, train traffic.
Yeah, this is a major nodal point for commuters in New Jersey who then go into New York by way of the PATH train, which is a subway under the river. There are, you know, this isn't the only train point entryway into New York. There is the tunnel for the Amtrak line, the Northeast Corridor, as well as New Jersey Transit uses that line that goes into Penn Station. So this is a terminus where you get off the train and you take either the subway or a ferry into New York. So it could be worse, but it's, you know, this is a storied terminal. It's historic. It was hammered during the Hurricane Sandy. It had about 12 feet of water, and commuting was disrupted at that time. It's also the place where on 9/11 Many, many people were ferried from the World Trade Center to Hoboken Terminal. So this is a place that has lived through and handled a lot of crises in its time.
Well, WNYC's Nancy Solomon there on the scene and where her train came this morning in Hoboken. Nancy, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we're keeping an eye on oil prices today after a big jump yesterday following news that OPEC member countries have agreed to cut output for the first time since 2008. Business journalist Ali Velshi joins us now. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
And this agreement came after a six-hour meeting in Algeria. Why do you think it came now? Because people have been talking about OPEC deciding to cut output for a long time, and they haven't done it until now.
Yeah, look, there are a number of things going on around oil, but one of the most important are the tensions, the growing geopolitical tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Saudi Arabia does not want to keep losing market share. It's losing some to Iran because Iran had been off the international market for so long, and now with sanctions lifted, it's getting back some of its old market. And of course, Saudi Arabia has been losing market share to Canada because of the oil sands and to the United States because of fracking. So the only way Saudi Arabia could maintain its market share was to keep increasing production and lower costs. They needed to figure out a way to get oil prices to stabilize. Iran doesn't want to cut output because it says, we've been off the market for decades. We want our share back. So getting these two to agree was going to be the hardest thing to overcome. They seem to have agreed. I'll tell you, Jeremy, most OPEC deals don't hold. But the fact is they've at least agreed to try.
So how much of a cut are we likely to see in the end, and how much is it likely to impact oil prices?
Well, it's not much because there's a glut of oil production around the world. Increasingly, the world is using less oil, and it's producing more. So this is a total production cut of 2%. It won't take effect until probably December. They've agreed to cut between 200,000 and 700,000 barrels a day. Now, let me just give you a sense of that. They'll reduce output to about 32.5 to 33 million barrels a day. Current output is 33.25 million barrels a day. So it's not that big a deal, but there are a few countries, Iran, Libya, Nigeria, they said under no circumstances can we afford to cut. So those three countries will be allowed to increase production. Saudi will cut production by 500,000 barrels a day.
We know that one of the things that OPEC has been thinking about over the last many years is that by not cutting production when prices were low, they were trying to push a lot of the new U.S. Energy producers out of the business, make it so unprofitable that they wouldn't want to produce anymore. What is all of this likely to mean for U.S. producers?
Well, it has worked. That strategy did work. It's very, very hard to say what the price of a barrel of oil needs to be to make fracking profitable, because it depends on how long you've been fracking and how much equipment you have. But the bottom line is, fracking is a much more expensive way of getting oil out of the ground than drilling is. Experts say that somewhere in the $57 to $60 a barrel range is where oil needs to be for it to be profitable to be fracking in the United States. We're nowhere close to that. In fact, on this deal, oil prices jumped 5% yesterday, and then they dropped again. Because the market's not sure whether it's enough. They're not sure whether it'll hold. So oil prices are under $50 a barrel right now. Unless they're close to 60 for a sustained period of time, it is going to have no net effect on American oil production.
The stock market also jumped yesterday in this country after this news. What is the connection between oil prices going up and the stock market going up? And is this likely to have an impact on the stock market?
Well, so the direct impact in the United States is profitability. If you have a 401k, the likelihood is one of the most profitable parts of your portfolio over the last several years has been energy. It is one of the major industries in the United States. And with the falling price of oil over the last couple of years, energy stocks have taken a massive, massive beating. So the idea is if oil prices go up to the point that American companies can start to profit from it, and remember, American companies are multinational companies, so they don't just profit from fracking, they profit from oil production all over the world. But if oil costs were to go up, oil prices were to go up, these companies would be more profitable, and that was the expectation on which the stock market rose. It also signals a lessening of geopolitical tensions if Saudi Arabia and Iran can sit in the same room in Algeria and come to a deal, because it has looked over the last few few months, like those countries are close to a lot of tension. So that's part of it. But the stock market's been quite fickle for the last few weeks. I wouldn't put too much stock in it.
And of course, most Americans aren't going out and buying barrels of oil, but we do buy gas at the pump. Is this likely to impact the price of gas?
Well, it hasn't moved the price very much. I will say this, the net effect for Americans of lower gas prices over the last year far exceeds the loss that you're getting in terms of a stock market gain. So a lot of Americans and people around the world are much happier to have lower oil prices. This is one of the great conundrums. When are oil prices so low that they affect your economy, even if you think you're getting a great deal at the pump? So, you know, experts are trying to figure out what the right price of oil is, and most of them think that at $40 a barrel, it's still a little low. At $50 or $60 a barrel over a sustained period of time, that seems to be a good balance between low gas prices and a good economy.
Business journalist Ali Velshi. Ali, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
An ancient poem, sometimes called the Romeo and Juliet of the Middle East, is being brought into the 21st century by choreographer Mark Morris, with musical accompaniment by members of Yo-Yo Ma's Silk Road Ensemble. It's a little bit of Layla and Majnun, a 12th century Persian poem about Layla, a beautiful young woman, and her sweetheart Kais. Their families won't let them marry. He goes mad with love and becomes Majnun, Arabic for crazy. And like Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, it does not end well. The singer is Alim Kazimov, who's been called the greatest singer alive, and he's a national treasure in his native Azerbaijan. He sings the role of Majnun. His daughter Fargana sings the role of Layla. Layla and Majnun premieres this weekend in Berkeley, California, and choreographer Mark Morris joins us now from there. Mark, what a web you weave here. When did it occur to you to bring all of this together with dance?
Well, in fact, it didn't occur to me. This is a complicated story. I'll try and make it clear. But it's a piece of music that was called actually the first Muslim opera. And it premiered in 1908 in Baku, Azerbaijan. And it was a young composer who'd spent a lot of time in Europe and in Russia. He was from Azerbaijan. Haji Bailey is his name. And he wanted to introduce the idea of opera to his home culture. And so it was written for a big Western orchestra. And some of the arias were done in the style, the ancient style of mugam singing, which is a kind of singing very, very, what's the word, ecstatic.
Yeah.
And so it's a type of singing that's all over the Middle East, all over the steppes of Central Asia, as we can say, and a big part of the Islamic culture. And it's about 2.5 hours long, and it's a big spectacle, which I love. But Mr. Kasimov and Mr. Ma together decided to bring this to, let's say, a Western audience in a smaller version. So it's a sort of a chamber orchestra of Western instruments, Azerbaijani instruments, and these two singers, Alim and Fergana, who are wonderful together. They sing the roles of Layla and Majnun. And it's a piece that's about an hour long. And I was asked if I would be interested in staging it as a full-on stage production as opposed to merely a concert. A concert's enough for a lot of things. But to actually present it as the show. And I originally said no because I just thought it was so sad and so slow and so mournful and so desolate and, to me, hopeless. And I loved it. I loved the music, but I couldn't see it turning into a stage show. And then they worked on the music a little bit, and I worked on my thoughts a little bit. And then a few years later, in fact, maybe just a couple years ago, I decided to take it on as a full-on danced opera. My dancers, the Mark Morris Dance Group, the Silk Road Ensemble, on stage, there are two players who play traditional Azerbaijani instruments, the kamanche and the tar, and these two marvelous, marvelous singers.
Well, so many questions. Let's listen, though, first to a little more of this extraordinary music, and not just one voice, but two, because of Alim's daughter, Fargana, who's also singing. And You mentioned it's improv a little bit, so let's listen. People, go to YouTube, you know, and listen to Alim Kazimov. I mean, it's like it's the voice is incredible, extraordinary, and yet you mentioned it's improv. So how does this work, Mark Morris, with dancers who, you know, one false move and the whole thing could fall apart?
Well, that's what live theater is all about. And that's the thrill of it. You know, everybody goes to the circus hoping against hope that somebody will die, but not really, you know. So it's the danger of that that's fascinating. And I have to tell you, my dancers, first of all, are super, super smart. They recognize the text. We don't speak Azerbaijani, but we recognize things and we recognize modulations in the music. And so we take cues from the singers. They take cues from us. So it's all a little bit adjustable at the moment. And since we always work with live music, my dancers are especially alert and attuned to the variations that are possible.
Can you, I mean, it is radio. Can you describe, so when you hear...
It's radio, that's why I have no pants on.
Me neither.
Yeah, Ray, yay, okay.
So we have the music, we have the story, we have lyrics like Majnun's last words, he's off in the desert. Only the one who's willing to sacrifice his life for his sweetheart can be called a lover. The soul that hasn't been given to a sweetheart is wasted, and he, you know, dies. What are you thinking of, and how is that translating? Can you describe what the dancers are doing?
No.
Okay.
I will tell you something that the sort of label of the Romeo and Juliet of. Romeo and Juliet had sex before they didn't. And Layla and Majnun are separated just before puberty. And the point is not that they're deprived physical love, but that their love is exclusively in their heads and in their minds and in their devotion to each other. So it's really, of course, a metaphor, a Sufi metaphor for love, eternal love, love of God, if you want to. I don't say it that way, but a love that isn't a lust and that is a deeper and purer and more lasting than corporeal earthly love. So that's the punchline, you know.
Right.
And
you're trying
to
express that through the dance.
Yes. And so I don't describe dances because that's why I make up dances. But as far as the show goes, you just have to go there.
You just have to see
it. You have to go to hear and watch and sit quietly and be changed.
Mark Morris, I have to ask. I was reading an interview you did in 2013. And this is not unusual for you to be sort of exploring another culture. When asked about the music that you listen to, you replied, "I would say Bach cantatas, hula, Hawaiian music, country western music from the 30s and 40s, all of it."
Yeah, well, and way more than that. That was just a little tiny sampler.
But what is it about this piece? It's Middle East. Is it political?
Well, The timing of this doesn't hurt. I mean, I'm not trying to teach anybody a lesson. I'm presenting this piece, which is about love. You know, everybody, as far as I can tell, in the world loves their children. And so, of course, it's easy to cite the sort of Islamophobia, this bizarre word, the sort of general bashing of each other in many different categories, between many different categories. And so it's not a corrective. It's an exposure to an aspect of a culture that a lot of Western people, and not just Judeo-Christian Western people, don't have exposure to. The music is very, very appealing. The story is, of course, universal, like every good story. And, you know, I also say to people who are who aren't used to hearing this kind of music, it's – well, try it, first of all. It's incredibly ecstatic and thrilling. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of, you know, very popular a couple decades ago, the Qawwali style of singing from Pakistan, a Sufi tradition. Mm-hmm. It also reminds me of what's called cante hondo in Andalusian music, of deeply passionate improvised flamenco singing. And it's a cri de coeur, you know, it's the heart singing to another heart. And that sounds very corny, and everything can become corny the closest it becomes to being emotionally truthful. And that's what happens here.
By the way, you mentioned the Sufis several times. Will your mm-hmm. dancers twirl?
Listen, one of the steps that dancers do the world over is twirl, okay? So that's what I'm going to tell you.
But nobody
they
twirls
do in the
like
ballet
Sufis.
Too.
But nobody yeah, twirls well, like Sufis. They're like tops.
Well, yes. I'm not telling you anything more about that.
Okay.
You can just assume yes.
Perhaps.
Whatever your questions are, yes, it's included. How about that?
Some whirling dervishes make their way into Mark Morris's new work, Layla and Majnun, which premieres this weekend in Berkeley, California, and elsewhere in the months ahead. Mark Morris, just quick question. Once called the bad boy of modern dance, you're
that.
Okay.
I'm 60. Okay, I'm 60. Thank you.
Well, and still a little bad boy or?
No. Never was bad. Just frank.
All right.
The honest gentleman of modern dance. You can call me that. That's a better thing.
Okay. Frank Morris.
Yeah, that's right.
Mark, thank you so much.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
Colombia's president, Juan Manuel Santos, said today that Pope Francis will visit his country next year. The announcement comes just days after Santos signed a peace agreement with the leftist rebel group known as the FARC. The Pope had expressed support for the accord during the negotiations. The agreement is significant, though, for reasons much larger than just Colombia. It represents the first time in 60 years that there isn't a single war in the Americas. Geographically, that's more than 30 countries stretching from the Canadian Arctic to the bottom of South America. Joining us now to talk about that is Greg Myrie, digital editor for NPR News. And Greg, the conflicts that have raged in Latin America for decades seem to have one thing in common, which would be the Cold War.
Yeah, Jeremy, that was really the driving force. I think the best place to start is with Fidel Castro and his band of rebels in 1956, where they gathered in exile in Mexico, landed on the southern shore of Cuba, and waged a successful revolution. And since then, we've had 60 years of insurgencies, mostly leftist insurgencies in Latin America. And effectively, that ended on Monday with the Colombian peace deal.
And what has the U.S. role been in all that time with the conflicts that have existed?
Well, certainly through most of that period, and certainly during the Cold War years, the U.S. was supporting pro-American governments. But that often meant authoritarian, dictatorial leaders, military rulers, for the most part, against these leftist insurgencies, with a few exceptions. But that was really the template. And again, it had sort of been set by Castro when he came to power and had all these imitators or people who wanted to imitate him with a leftist insurgency. And it really created this bipolar world of the U.S. on one side, Cuba and the Soviet Union on the other, and left no middle ground for moderates. You were either a sort of authoritarian ruler trying to crush an insurgency or these leftist rebel groups trying to win power.
And for the most part, with the exception of Cuba, as you say, and Nicaragua, none of the revolutions were actually successful.
Yeah, looking back on it, this is what's quite striking. I mean, at the peak in the 70s and 80s, you had insurgencies in virtually every single Latin American country. And yet, over the 60-year period, you only had two that succeeded. One was Castro in Cuba in 59. The other was the Sandinistas in 1979 in Nicaragua. But you had all of these years of warfare, the hundreds of thousands of death, all the damage and destruction that these wars caused. And ultimately, they got sorted out and led to elections. And now a lot of the groups that fought and couldn't win power on the battlefield have come to power through elections.
So here we are in 2016, for the first time in 60 years, no war in this part of the world, in the Americas, but not necessarily full-fledged peace.
Very true, Jeremy. You've got war, you've got peace, and you've got a lot of gray areas in between. There's still the drug violence in Colombia and Mexico, for example. In Central America, you have some of the highest murder rates in the world from Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras. Venezuela is a political and economic mess, as we've seen. So we're not saying there's perfect tranquility, but I think this was a very important development that's sort of been widely overlooked. This for the first time, North, Central, and South America do not, no place in the Americas have a war.
Worth pointing out, not perfect tranquility in this country either, with a lot of the things that we report on every day. Greg Myrie, digital editor for International News at NPR, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
Police in El Cajon, California confirm it was a vape smoking device that Alfred Alango pointed at police just before he was shot dead on Tuesday. His sister, Lucy Peterson, had called 911 and told them her brother suffered mental health issues. Here's a bit of the heartbreaking audio on the scene right after his death.
Oh my God, you killed my brother!
Do you have somebody you could call?
Peterson, the sister, went on to say, why didn't you send a crisis communication team? Well, it turns out El Cajon does have mental health professionals involved with the force. They weren't available that night. But there are other ways that police departments are handling mental health calls. In 2003, Major James Cleek helped start crisis intervention training in Indianapolis. He's now training bureau commander there. He joins us. And Jim, you've told us you can't comment too much on El Cajon. There will be an investigation. But tell us your initial thoughts when you heard about it.
Well, I think it took us back, took me back to several thoughts. And the reason why we have crisis intervention teams today in CIT, as it originated in Memphis in 88, in a very similar circumstance where officers shot a mentally ill subject and there was a cry for help from the community to find better ways to deal with those in crisis. And then we've come so far where there are over 3,000 CIT programs across the country. But what really probably hits home for me is that these families that do call the police are in a desperate situation where they really don't know what else to do.
This is a very personal issue to you.
It is. I have four children, three of which are adopted from Ukraine, and one of my three that are adopted from Ukraine was diagnosed with bipolar 2 in the last year. So as a family, we were just lucky enough to fight through the desperation ourselves and eventually get him on medication. And he's, by all intents and purposes, living a very productive life, has recently become an Eagle Scout. Mm. But what we know about the people that we serve here in Indianapolis, many of these people are not only desperate, but they don't have the resources. What happens is they call the police because they don't know who else to call.
Well, Jim, I have to ask you, though, when you see something like, you know, a person going through the break, the psychotic moment, that must make your blood run cold to think that it could have been your son and police responding not knowing that.
Well, I've thought about that. When we were in the middle of our crisis itself, I saw some of the warning signs, but I didn't see everything. And the difference is with someone who has a diagnosable mental illness and they're in the middle of that crisis is that all of the things that they're seeing, feeling, thinking are real, even though they may not be real to us. Mm. And for me, of course, I went through the same thoughts when my son was going through his issues, and then I had those talks with him that if he was in that place and he was to encounter the police, it was him that needed to slow things down and him that needed to listen to the commands.
Well, how lucky, first of all, that your son has you for a dad, that he could, you know, have that instruction. But when he's in the middle of a break, he might not be able to follow through on that. And most people don't have a dad who happens to work in crisis intervention. And as we're disclosing, I will as well, many listeners know I have a loved one who also struggled with mental health issues. And here in our area, Boston, we had a special team that you were assigned to. These were police officers who were specially trained. You had their cell phone numbers and you had coded language that you gave them when there was an issue. Is that part of what you'd like to see in cities? What happens in Indianapolis?
Well, in Indianapolis, we start from the beginning where all of our rookie officers go through 48 weeks of training before they graduate the academy, which is unheard of probably. We chunk training for CIT in response to mental illness and crisis throughout the first 26 weeks. We send them out to field training, then we bring them back for an advanced school for crisis intervention in an effort to change just the way we think because we believe it's so prevalent. I mean, there's some estimations out there that disturbance runs involve about 75% people who are either exhibiting signs of mental illness or addiction issues. And we need to give our officers every single tool, including technology, to be able to deal with that. But we believe starting with communication and de-escalation is the answer, realizing that sometimes that isn't an option when things are happening fast. Thus far, we've made it a rule that all of our rookies get the training. That was something that was unheard of, although now there are other major metropolitan area police departments across the country that are starting to do the very same thing. We do have many veteran officers also, so when the call goes out, dispatchers are trained to identify that call as a possible mental health crisis, and then we respond. But we also take it a step further where we have a behavioral health unit with mental health liaisons from Eskenazi Hospital who work on the districts with behavioral health units and do follow-ups with either repeat calls or people we know of or we come to know who are experiencing crisis and need that kind of help.
Yeah. What else do you do? I'm understanding that, I mean, one of the concerns, obviously, is when the mentally ill are armed. And we understand that there's a state law that allows police to confiscate and hold weapons from any person they suspect is mentally unstable or dangerous, even if that person hasn't committed a crime.
Well, that's true. We do have a law, and that was as a result of a past case in our history where one of our officers was killed by a person who we had had run-ins before, and now it does allow us to take those weapons temporarily in an effort to save, you know, brothers and sisters, moms and dads, officers, etc.
So Major James Cleek, again, he trains police officers to deal with mental health in Indianapolis. He himself is a crisis-trained officer. And he has a son who is winning the battle, we understand, with mental illness. So it seems like we have two things going on here. We have the families who fear for their loved ones and what their loved ones might do. But they might be watching what happened in El Cajon and say, I'm not going to call the police. Then you have the police who, especially I'm hearing of your fellow officers, want to help. And then, you know, they see a fellow officer shot and killed. How do we bridge that?
Well, I think it's difficult. When we started CIT, it was about the same time that Jake Laird was killed here, which was the officer that was killed by the person that was, really just completely off the grid but had semi-automatic weapons. We were introducing this training at the same time that had occurred, so we had a battle years ago of how do you balance this? What does this mean to officers? What we've seen is that more de-escalation, more communication, recognizing signs of mental illness and medications and learning different ways of talking to persons who are suffering from these things, reduced injuries to officers, to the person who was suffering from that crisis. And, you know, ultimately that's what we want. But if we don't have the resources, the places to take someone to get the help, it's an ongoing battle. Right. That might not be one.
Yeah. Well, and just briefly, should families with mentally ill loved ones reach out to the police?
Well, we have that happen quite often where families do contact us. They're referred to that behavioral health unit. We're also getting ready to introduce mental health first aid, which is another way to train on recognizing and, for lack of a better term, providing kind of mental health CPR.
James Cleek, Major James Cleek, I just have to ask you one last question. How ironic that you were working on this for years before your own child was diagnosed with mental illness. It seems to just show that you just never know.
Well, I wonder for a long time, you know. I have a heart for people. I definitely have a heart for people that can't help themselves, and that's why I became a police officer, so I could stand up for those that couldn't. Mental illness is one of those things that I know that affects people in so many ways. It affects families and moms and dads and brothers and sisters and everyone else. And I had no idea all those years, all those runs I was on, all of those places I was, you know, I ended up being as a police officer was preparing me to save the life of my son. And you know, that's pretty devastating.
That's Major James Cleek of the Indianapolis Police Department. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin, for having me.
Newspapers are making news with their endorsements. Today, the San Diego Union-Tribune endorsed Hillary Clinton, the first Democrat the paper's backed in its 148-year history. USA Today had an endorsement of sorts. The paper said at its founding in 1982 it would never endorse a candidate. Today, the paper's editorial board didn't endorse Clinton but called Donald Trump unfit for the presidency and told people to vote, but just not for him. This week, the Detroit News, the Chicago Tribune, tradition and endorsed Gary Johnson, the Libertarian, instead of Trump. Last week, the Dallas Morning News endorsed a Democrat for the first time since 1940. So what's going on? Does it matter? NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is here. And David, give us some more background on USA Today's decision. What did it say in 1982?
Well, Al Neuwirth, the founder, guy at the Gannett Corporation, you know, the parent company of USA Today, they wanted to create a paper that would appeal to people across the country geographically and across the country demographically. And one way to do that is not to offend people. This isn't the terms they would have used, but not to offend people by taking strong editorial stances. And you'll notice that most of the time when it does take some sort of editorial position, they have an opposing view presented equally prominently on those pages. In this case, they said, well, what should we do? Their entire editorial board unanimously, according to their account, did not want to support Trump. They expressly said it was important to say that publicly. And they thought about Al Neuwirth and his dictate to be even-handed and fair-minded and to essentially not inflame or to offend readers. But they also pointed back to a column he wrote 4 years ago in which he described Trump as, quote, a clown who loves doing or saying things to get attention, quote, no matter how ridiculous. And then they end sort of a sideline piece they write about this, explaining this editorial, saying, sounds like Al was onto something. They think they're in keeping with their own founder, even though he was the guy who said, don't endorse anyone.
Well, you know, and it's as many of these papers are now endorsing the first Democrat in their paper's history, it's not as if these conservative outlets are suddenly getting progressive. The Arizona Republic, the Dallas Morning News, Cincinnati Inquirer, all historically conservative editorial pages endorsed Hillary Clinton. But the Dallas paper told Texas voters, Trump is at odds with nearly every GOP ideal that this newspaper holds dear. Donald Trump is no Republican, certainly no conservative. It's because they feel they're conservative that they can't endorse him. The Arizona board wrote, oh boy, they really went to town. They wrote, we've never endorsed a Democrat over a Republican, never. This reflects a deep philosophical appreciation for conservative ideals. But Donald Trump responds to criticism with the petulance of verbal spitwads. I mean, there's something going on these editorial boards.
Sure. I think there are actually a couple different elements intertwined here, one of which is that many conservatives, people ideologically strong believers in conservative values, or at least what we associate with that term, think that Trump is uneven at best as a champion of those values and is inconsistent, often hypocritical about them. They question whether he sincerely holds them. I think some of these papers endorsing Hillary Clinton might have been more skeptical of Bernie Sanders had he been doing this. But you know, with Hillary Clinton in there, she's seen as pragmatic. She has worked with Republicans in the Senate and as well as Secretary of State, although Benghazi certainly serves as a counterpoint to that. And there are ways in which they say we are more comfortable with this, which leads us to the second strand, which is that there's a bit of a sort of elite populist divide on this, that I think that editorial boards tend to be more, shall we say, of the establishment. They tend to say who can get things done, who are people we can talk to and hear from and understand and recognize even when we disagree with them. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump doesn't represent that. Donald Trump is not only a disruptor. He's just he's unpredictable, not saying, hey, that's crazy and kooky. He's going to say something. He's unpredictable in terms of what forces his words or possibly as president his policies might unleash.
Well, I was going to ask you, don't you think this is just going to harden the view of most Trump supporters that the lousy media that he always points out at the rallies is just out to get him?
Right. Well, look, it will certainly go to underscore if he wants to use this as another way to say the media is against me and gosh darn it, you know, you guys have to stick it to the media and vote for me. He can make that case. If you remember George H.W. Bush, 1992, used to have bumper stickers that said annoy the media, reelect Bush. He was not reelected. And actually, he was a lovely guy to the media. He used to write handwritten notes to thank various reporters and columnists when they wrote complimentary things about him. So, you know, it works to fire up your base. Trump, of course, we've heard from our colleagues who cover politics, needs to expand on his base to get voters. I think it may harden and excite those for him to be able to say that.
Well, but the Washington Post points out that this is risky for newspapers to do at a time when they're losing readers. And they are because of these editorials. The Arizona Republican, Dallas Morning News said they've gotten death threats and people are canceling their subscriptions because of their stance against Donald Trump for Clinton. But we're wondering, too, is it worth the risk for them, perhaps, because do these endorsements mean more when it's a surprise?
I think endorsements don't mean much these days, particularly on the national level. They tend to mean more in local races. But let me say this. In a few slices, a few swing states, it could matter. It matters when it's unexpected. And newspapers, I think, as their finances declines, have to stand for something. One thing that they can do is they can do investigative reporting, accountability reporting. In this case, on the other side of the ledger, the editorial side, they say they want to stand for something, and that something isn't Donald Trump.
David Fogenflik, NPR's media correspondent, weighing in on the many newspaper, surprising newspaper endorsements. David, thank you.
You bet.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.